Okay, some of the people here in the program are involved with the membranes and polymers and so on, so we thought that we would start discussing some of these aspects perhaps today and continuing, if necessary, at another time. People that expressed interest in doing this, well, there was Arlette, she's leaving this afternoon, so at some point I might stop what I'll be discussing, and you might jump in whenever you feel it's the right time. Garek Papoyan, he has also a few questions to ask. He'll probably be here at some point. There are still people on the other room where Ronnie was giving a talk this morning. And then Mark also had a few things to show. So, whenever you feel in to jump in, just do. In the group back in Strasbourg, we have been doing different things with respect to membranes. Some of them are related to membrane-polymer interactions, and perhaps these are the ones that are the most interest here for the people in this program. But I'd like also to tell one or two things about other, what we think are interesting theoretical questions that arise in the field of membranes themselves, and sometimes they inspire questions for the polymer field. Just to remember what we are talking about, you probably all know about this, so I can go fast. We are talking about self-assembled bilayers that are built from bricks like this one. These are the molecules that assemble. And in practice, you can make these assembled bilayers from sizes as small as 20 nanometers, so very small ones, up to sometimes we get 100 microns or more under our microscopes. Single bilayer, closed vesicle, so these things can be made in all sizes. There is not a very good method to make these of the size that you want. You know, if you tell me I want a 33.5 radius vesicle, I don't know the recipe to do that. Probably I do giant vesicles, and then we need to go and choose the ones of the right size that we need.
Width of the layer is the same in all of them?
Yes, 5 nanometers. That depends on the structure, on the molecular structure of the phospholipids. If the lipid has a longer tail, of course, the membrane is a little bit thicker and so on.
How do you prevent one else from forming?
From the formation method, the
protocol to make.
When you just hydrate lipids, the typical method, I don't have a transparency here on it, I probably have somewhere on the computer, but the typical method is to put the lipids on a good solvent like chloroform and then spread them on a surface and then hydrate somehow. And if you just do this, you end up with all kinds of structures, multilamellar, unilamellar, all kinds of sizes, tubular structures, and so on. Then depending on the size you want, and if you want unilamellar or not, then you usually need to input energy into the system somehow. So you can sonicate, you can extrude. Extrusion is very popular, so you make this soup of lipids that have been hydrated, and you push them through a membrane with a given pore size. And if you look at the recipes, they tell you should do it 11 times or 12. So you go zoom, zoom, and in the end, they are unilamellar and nicely distributed. But of course, there is a large polydispersity. If you want to make them very large, then you go to the electroformation method. That's the most popular method for
doing that. Do you care that they are unilamellar?
Well, these things, they don't stick to each other, as a matter of fact. I mean, because they are made of the same lipids, so if they have the same charges, they repel. But this one, for instance, this is ruteroionic, and as a matter of fact, is not charged. If you have two lamellas, the membranes are not stuck to each other, and they repel a little bit. So you can see the membranes individually, as a matter of fact. Due to the fluctuations of the membrane.
If they are multilamellar.
If they are multilamellar, if you have two or three or four or more, yeah, you see them.
Actually, I'll tell some about observations of the inner mitochondria membrane. And I mean, it's not what I'm going to show, but when they knock out certain proteins, they see onions and other structures coming in.
The other thing that people do is, of course, the freeze thaw.
So that's an alternative method to do small liposomes. So when you get to these original soup that I was talking about, instead of sonicating or extruding through a membrane with pores, what you can do is to freeze it and melt it, freeze it and melt it many times. And this usually gives also a given size and unilamellar as well. It has not been very well studied, but what people say is that by freezing you somehow cut the thing into little pieces locally, and then when you reheat, they come back to life and are able to rearrange. So it's always a question of putting energy into the system so the system is able to rearrange differently. So this is the electroformation method. This is what I was talking about. You take lipids, put them on a chloroform, and then spread them on a surface. And when you do that, the thing pre-orders at the surface, as a matter of fact. So you should imagine that you put as much lipids as necessary to have, say, 10 or 50 layers, which are dried layers, of course, because the chloroform evaporates. And then this starts to rehydrate when you add water. What you do is to do it like this. And then if you apply an electric field across that little system, then needs to be some amplitude, some frequency. After a while, you get the vesicles.
And there's a protocol written somewhere what frequency used to extract given sizes?
So each group that does these has its own protocols. They are all related to each other, but this is like cooking, yes. Some people, for instance, ramp the frequency or ramp the amplitude or change from sinusoidal oscillations into square-like oscillations to help the thing detach in the end. So this is more like cooking. Something important that has been discovered perhaps 2 years ago or 3 years ago is that you can grow vesicles by this method even if they are charged. And you can even grow extracts from cells. So you just take the extracts, use the same method, and you can reconstitute it somehow by playing a simple trick, which is instead of working at, say, 10 hertz, you need to go to much higher frequencies, 500 hertz or 1,000 hertz, and that allows to grow giant vesicles out of charged species.
And the circles there inside are not...
Yeah, what are the things you see inside?
You mean in the picture?
Yeah.
Inside the big one, there's
small.
Yeah, there could be small bits of membranes in this one. So this one is not. So when you grow them, some of them are very nice, so you don't see any of these spots or even tubes or whatever. So like I was saying, when you prepare the system, you get a whole variety of different things. And you need to choose the one that you are going to work with. In practice, you work with one that you choose under the microscope. So you never do collective measurements with these big ones. Collective measurements are performed with the liposomes and move around. Okay, so I was telling about these the other day already, but we look at them close to the surface by this interference method, which is called RICM. The biologists, they prefer TIF, which requires putting fluorophores on the membrane. This doesn't require any fluorescence and tells you how close the membrane is to the surface and what is size and its actual conformation when you are looking at that. It's very nice because it has a very good vertical precision. When you stretch them, one way of doing this is by playing with osmotic pressure. So something that you need to have in your lab when you go into this field, the first thing you buy is an osmometer.
And how do you make the solution inside the vesicle and outside the vesicle?
Well, when you grow them in some solution, and then you extract them and
put... flush.
Well, usually, you know, these are ITO plates. They are not very nice to do microscopy with because there is a high reflection there on that metallic surface. So you usually transfer what you got in that little growing cell into an observation cell or a micromanipulation cell. So you transfer them. If you compute how many of these things in the good days, you might have 100,000 or 1 million vesicles in your growing solution. So you transfer them. If you go by brute force, you might break the big ones, but you always end up with many, many vesicles. And so you transfer them into the other solution. You usually grow them in sucrose, which is heavy, and transfer them into glucose, so that you have a good contrast to see them, and you have them coming down to the substrate because they are a little bit heavier than the environment, but you always match the osmotic pressure so that they don't feel stretched. This 1 year, it's probably a higher pressure inside than outside, that's why it's stretched.
It's not trivial to get a height from an interference pattern like this.
Well, the difficulty that you might have if you want to go very high is on a complicated pattern from the one from the right, is to know at which cycle you are. The way of solving that degeneracy problem is to use two wavelengths. And so there is a two-wavelength variation of this method that, as a matter of fact, allows you to know exactly where you are in height.
So use two lasers,
for instance, yes. If you are dealing with systems like the one in the left, there is no question about that because, you know, you just follow from one peak to the other, and that's not a problem. So one of the things we have looked into the past, so this brings about a problem that we might consider discussing for polymers, was looking into these vesicles under a suction pressure. This is a way of actually probing the membrane elasticity. What you do is you bring a 10 micron thick a piece of glass that you have prepared by stretching a capillary tube, and then you apply a pressure difference. This was a method developed most by Evan Evans in the past. So we do that. You can see the usual variation of the surface that enters that suction tube as a function of the pressure that you apply. And this is well-known stuff. I can talk more about it if you want, but go ahead.
What happens with the contact between your vesicles and the glass? Is there any problem with lipids sticking or interaction changes, or how do you, assuming that there is no, it's almost like an inert hard surface, but in reality there's glass discharge.
Right. So, The quality of the contact that you get, again, depends on which group is working with these and on the preparation methods, mainly of the micropipettes. Some people stretch them under a flame and then cut it by a method which amounts to bringing a liquid, freeze it such that it cuts in a neat way. And depending on the type of stretching method and preparation method that you use, your glass might stick more or less with the vesicle. So in practice, most of the people that do these experiments, and we do too, we always use some kind of protein or polymer to cover the glass such that you don't have any longer stickiness from the glass to. It's very easy to see because if you bring your glass and you touch the vesicle, and when you pull it back, the vesicle comes and you are not applying any suction pressure, then there is a problem and you need to treat your glass. So there are different methods for treating the glass surfaces. Okay, but so this thing that we have done is kind of puzzling for the membranes and perhaps for the polymers as well. We apply a suction pressure under shear.
So selecting on the surface, or are you selecting surfaces?
Right, I don't pressures. Have. So this is the micropipette. There is a a depression here, so I applying a suction pressure.
That's not oscillating.
That's not oscillating, no. Just constant pressure. And this surface in here, which it can be perhaps 100 microns or a few hundred microns above the vesicle, is shearing this way. So in practice, the vesicle is feeling the viscous stresses applied by the flow that I create with this upper surface. Okay. And when you do that, what you see is that the equilibrium position of this bit of membrane that entered the tube, as a matter of fact, is displaced. It becomes larger. And if I stop the flow, then at constant pressure, then the thing goes back to the original position. So by applying this shear, the vesicle somehow is able to enter more the micropipette. Now, why was the vesicle able to enter the micropipette to start with before the shear flow? Is because there are fluctuations that were unfolded by the tension that I'm applying to it. And so everything happens as if when I apply a shear flow in here, some of the fluctuations are even more released, such that at constant pressure, I get more surface than without the shear flow.
Why does that explain that when you stop the shear flow that it comes back? Because it comes
well, because then the flows, what we believe is that the fluctuations here are being suppressed by the shear flow. And so when you stop the flow, the fluctuations rebuild again because everything is in thermal conditions. And so the force increases again outside and the membrane goes back to its zero flow equilibrium position.
So it's basically modulating the surface tension?
The way you can think about this, this is just technical stuff. Of course, these shear stresses are inhomogeneous around that vesicle. So in a sense, it's not a very pure experimental situation because you are not applying an homogeneous shear around the vesicle. Because you are shearing here, the flow lines are such that you are applying more shear stress in the top than in the bottom, so this is an inhomogeneous stress situation from the point of view of the vesicle. But in order to explain our results, which are really how much the vesicle enters as a function of shear rate, and these are always linear, let me show you what this amounts to from the point of view of the relation between the surface and the pressure. I'll come back to this. So everything, as you know, if you have a membrane under tension, there is this so-called Elfrisch relation that tells you what is the excess area relation with the tension on the membrane. And this is generated by the entropic, by the fluctuations of the membrane. And by extracting from that slope this prefactory, that's how you get the bending modulus experimentally. So this is without the shear flow. In our case, in the presence of the shear, everything happens as if the constitutive relation between the excess area and the tension in the membrane got another term, which now depends on shear flow, and strangely depends linearly on shear flow in here.
Which regime are you in terms of this Debrand Handler lessening?
So the relaxation
gamma dot is
the first model of the membrane.
So the relaxation time of these big vesicles is roughly 1 second.
That's what you call tau zero.
So tau zero we extracted from the experiments. And what we get is about 100 seconds, as a matter of fact.
It's the longest.
So it's longer than the longest relaxation time of our vesicles, as a matter of fact.
100 times long.
100 times long, more or less, yes.
So what is this time?
that we don't know. So.
So basically, you're saying that the transition.
I'm not saying that we have a theory to explain this. What I say is that our experimental results can be explained by a constitutive, by a modification of the constitutive equation, which is this one of that form.
But what, so asking, how big is this number? How big is the Deborah number?
Deborah number is 10 to minus 12, he's saying.
Oh, how much?
10 to minus 2.
With this big times?
Well.
With real time.
Well, the first, okay,
now the first thing we need to realize is that we are doing oscillatory shear flows. So as a matter of fact, we have both amplitude variation and frequency variation. And so the what we call here the shear rate is the product of, we extract it from the velocity. It's not only the pulsation of the of the oscillation.
So it's, so gamma dot is one, is omega or not?
No, gamma dot is not omega.
What is gamma dot?
So gamma dot is the actual shear rate, which depends on the shear amplitude that you have. So on the angle that you are applying. So you are doing this, right?
It's a smaller
thing. It's gamma omega. Gamma dot is gamma omega. I mean,
it's gamma times omega, exactly. It's the shearing angle, or the shearing amplitude times the frequency, right? So
if you keep omega constant and change your amplitude, it's still linear, right?
Yes.
And so
everything depends on gamma dot, as a matter of fact.
Which is amplitude. Strain amplitude times.
So if this is gamma, the maximum amplitude of your, then gamma dot would be gamma times omega.
Okay.
Okay.
So there is there is no good explanation of why Deborah number is so small.
I'm not sure I would call this a Deborah number here, but because that would imply that we are looking into how the shear perturbs the internal fluctuations of the membrane, which we believe it is. But this, as I was saying, this is not a theory. This is just a modification of the constitutive equation.
If the perturbation is very slow, you see nothing. So presumably, at some rate of perturbation of your compared to the longest mode, you start seeing something, and that's typically called the Deborah number.
So two pieces of information to understand why we came up with an equation like this. This is because we do two different kinds of experiments. In one experiment, we keep the pressure constant and we increase the shear rate. So by keeping the pressure constant, it's like keeping the tension constant, and we vary the shear rate and we get the vesicle to enter the micropipette. We do also other kind of experiments, which is to keep the shear rate constant and to apply a larger suction pressure. And when you do that, as a matter of fact, what you see is that you still get these curves, which are like if you are applying a suction pressure in a normal experiment, if you didn't know that the shear was on, you'd still be doing the usual experiment on vesicles extracting the membrane surface, except that you have the impression that your vesicle is softer. So there is a variation of the effective bending modulus. Of course, this is not the true bending modulus, but everything happens like if you had an effective bending modulus that decreases with shear rate like that. So this is a vesicle in absence of flow. This is a section experiment in the presence of flow. So these two kinds of experiments, increasing the shear at constant pressure and decreasing the pressure at constant shear, can only be described or explained by a constitutive equation like this.
What sigma mean?
Is some value.
What is their physical meaning?
I don't know. I know the value we need to input.
What is the ratio of sigma min and sigma max?
Let me just tell you first what is usually sigma max. So sigma max in an experiment in the absence of flow is related to the total amount of modes that are stored in the membrane. As a matter of fact, you can take a characteristic tension built from KBT and the smallest length that you have in the problem, say the thickness of the membrane, and then sigma max is the maximum tension that you can get by multiplying the number of modes that you have in the membrane by that reference tension.
The ratio of the area of the membrane to the square of the thickness.
No. Is the ratio, right, it's something like that.
No, that's wait a minute, only the first term, I think sigma max is kappa over a square, delta square, delta is the, if you just take excess area of frame membrane, forget about the second term.
Yeah.
Don't you get sigma max explicitly as the cutoff, the short wavelength cutoff, so you get something like kappa over a squared, where a is the thickness of the membrane, some short wavelength cutoff, no?
Right, but
I remember.
But when you when you look into how much tension you get to start with on a membrane that has been prepared by this electroformation method,
so it's related to sigma max, it's sigma.
Well, sigma depends then on the pressure that you apply, right? No, but what I'm saying is that a membrane, when you prepare it to start with, might have different states of tension. Okay? So those states of tension depends how the membrane was closed during the preparation of it.
This is the sigma.
That's the...
That's the sigma.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Sigma mass is just a couple of...
Yeah, but it's a high tension that you usually never measure in the experiments, as a matter of fact. Okay.
Just to understand the equation, superscript A is what? Is the equilibrium area?
So these are the this is the true area of the membrane,
right,
which is fluctuating,
yeah.
And this in here is the apparent area that you see from the projection on your microscope.
Okay.
And so a sphere, for instance. And because the membrane is larger, of course, than the area that you see, you are able to extract a little bit of excess area. You are usually able to extract 2%, 4% under normal conditions.
Last term is negative, because sigma min is smaller than sigma, or what? This land is negative, no?
Yeah, you always work on conditions such that this is the largest tension that you have in the system. But let me tell something that makes this discussion a little bit less relevant. The thing is that you never measure these in absolute terms. What you do are differences between the state of the membrane, say, at the entrance of the micropipette, and a little bit later. So what you measure are differences between these terms in here. So you actually never measure sigma max. Okay, this is something you don't measure in the experiment. The fact that the area varies with this constitutive relation, as a matter of fact, what it tells in practice is that the shear flow is helping to extract fluctuation. So it's reducing the spectrum, it's coupling to the fluctuation such that they do not contribute to the force, to the tension on the membrane. It's like if you are smearing off fluctuations.
So you're thinking about renormalizing tension, that's what I was saying. By suppressing fluctuations, you
By suppressing fluctuations, you are decreasing the tension.
Effective surface tension.
Increasing.
No, not the surface. You mean the tension?
Yeah.
You are decreasing it, yes.
You are decreasing
it. So that is easier to extract,
right,
to extract the fluctuations. And we don't have a theory for this, but this reminds us that we don't have a theory neither for an equivalent situation for polymers. So the situation which is be similar to this for a polymer would be the following. I take a chain like this, and in order to bring it to some extension, I probably even have a little graph on this. I know that I need to apply a force. Now, this force, the origin of this force is, of course, on the fluctuations on this chain. If there were no fluctuations, there would be no force. Now, let me do the same thing. I put a shear flow in here. Let's make it oscillatory shear flow in the same manner with some gamma dot in here. And what I say we don't know is if the force that you need to apply here to keep the chain at the same distance is going to increase, to decrease, or to stay the same as you turn on the shear flow. You think so, but
you've been experimentally or
theoretically? Experimentally, I don't think it has been done yet. I know of at least one group that is trying to look into that. And theoretically, I don't know the answer.
So yeah, it suppresses.
It suppresses fluctuation, you think?
Well, I mean, we didn't even calculate it.
So we went on to try to do some simulations on this Langevin type and so on, and the answer that we get, as a matter of fact, is the reverse.
That
you need to apply a larger force to keep it at the same distance. But
a larger pulling force.
A larger pulling force, right?
Stiffer, not softer.
It becomes stiffer, yes.
And it's not because of the torque
you're
applying, because there's also this. You're doing
a shear. So you are doing a shear, and of course this shear is oscillatory shear.
Right, so on average there's nothing.
So on average there is nothing in there. So it's.
Marcus, do you put a constraint in your simulation with that thing? It has to be all the time in the direction of the flow, or the end-to-end, or
yes, it's in direction of the flow.
No, but it wants to do other things as well. So, do you have any constraint on that or not?
This thing is at the plane of zero. You know, if you are above, of course, you need to extract the average component that would make it drift. But
so why is it stiffer?
So we see a number of configurations which are like this, as a matter of fact. So like if locally,
it turns.
It doesn't turn globally, but it's like if locally, and that consumes
length.
And that consumes length.
So it's because of the torque.
So it's because of the rotational component of the shear, but it's not obvious that it should stiffen it, because you do this and then you do that, right? You rotate one way and you rotate the other way.
What case use up some length?
That's true. So on average, you stiffen it up a little
bit.
Well,
it's kind of tricky, okay.
So it's a tricky question, right? So that's why we think it's interesting.
But when you would apply the uniform shear, you would probably see that it's softer.
Well, if it's just an uniform shear, then you induce drift, extension, stretching, and so on. People have looked at this. If you just keep it like that.
Keep it like that in uniform state, what happens? It will still create those next little things.
In an uniform flow, in an uniform flow, you just accumulate matter there, right? So it's easier to, if the flow is just like that. That's what you meant?
No, in steady shear flow.
Oh, in a steady shear flow, right?
Right, that's rather, so you want your solution.
Instead of being oscillatory.
You'll still have your loop, extra length loops appear. You'll still have the same effect appearing. So
yes.
In that case, you also have the same effect.
You have the same effect, but you could imagine that it's suppressed by the oscillatory nature of it, right?
No, I mean, okay, there are two sort of opposite effects here, because one of them is that you get the, you're holding the chain anyway, so it's oriented, yeah?
It's oriented.
You don't have to orient it, it doesn't flip.
No, you're holding.
It doesn't flip, okay, so in this case, okay, then maybe you're right, yeah, that's right. Then it's
okay.
Now, you said this is a result for simulations.
Right.
And so, our simulations tend to be at a high shear rate. Is that?
Well, different numbers would be a lot.
Well, we use shear rates comparable to the relaxation time of the chain.
You can get to that for sure.
But our chains are short. I mean, we are not talking about DNAs here.
That's the basic question. Can you get those? Are you pushing it into a different
channel? Okay, question number one. Let's go to the next, or?
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So in that in those simulations, when you look at that fourth relationship as a function of frequency, is it like a linear relationship too, or?
No.
No,
we don't get the same behavior as.
What is the relaxation? What is the rotation time of your sphere, of your vesicle? Not anything that has to do with just rotation.
You mean the rotation time of a vesicle in a solution?
Because the experiment is attached to a solution.
You attach it. So obviously, the lowest mode really is just rotating your vesicle. You are holding it by one end, it rotates. Mm. So, I mean, that's what shear does. So, what is the rotation time?
Well, the thing I should say is that in the experimental configuration, this thing is about 500 microns from the surface. The vesicle is about 50 micrometers down there. And I'm applying shear amplitudes, which are roughly 1 micron or so. So at the level of the vesicle, the displacements are, say, 50 nanometers or even less. So from the optical point of view, we don't see the vesicle moving at all.
Right.
This shear is so small.
There is no sound
rotation mode
of the
exactly.
Motion.
Like a solid body, you know. Yeah. This kind of, what is that for a vesicle this size? I mean, this is easy to.
It could be huge.
It could be huge. That may be your hammer for 100.
8 pi r cubed over 80, right?
It should be comparable to the Zim time of the vesicle itself, which is about 1 second.
Is what?
1 second.
Not 100.
Not 100. No, we don't get to 100. But the vesicle is not doing this massively. Maybe it's doing it a little bit, but as I was saying, the displacements of water against the vesicle locally are 50 nanometers.
It doesn't matter. It's still, if you're talking a linear regime, you're coupling to this is the mode that's available.
Which is what is the relevant mode with your coupling?
Amplitude doesn't matter.
Right. Because you see what may be happening in some sense that you are stretching it against this pressure which you're applying suction. Okay, like that. It's not suppressing graduation, but just stretching with the shear flow.
Well, the other thing you should also know is that all these membranes, they are completely in a liquid state. So as a matter of fact, this is a piece of liquid. So the membrane, if it needs to rotate like this, it's not clear that the stresses outside will be transmitted shear-wise to the ones inside. You can create internal shear on the vesicle membrane easily, because this is just a piece of liquid. So I don't need to imagine that my vesicle is completely rotating inside the micropipette. I could be rotating
then,
a little bit outside.
Then it's even more complicated than the problem. So we have to consider the rotation of the fluid inside. So this means the time scale associated with this kind of motion.
You mean inside the vesicle or inside the pipette?
Inside the pipette. Inside the vesicle.
Okay, so I'd be glad to further discuss these things. Let's go to other stuff, okay. So this is somewhat related to the discussion that Professor Kardar started the other day. We have been interested for a while in the interactions that polymers and surfaces might have. And what we found out more or less at the same time that Roland is not here, Roland and Lipovsky did, is that the polymer locally, when it's attached to a surface, it applies an inhomogeneous pressure at the point where it's grafted. Because, of course, the concentration of monomers is higher at that grafting point. And it decreases from the grafting point, and you can compute these things reasonably, at least for a Gaussian chain, and then for. So we have played with that a while. We wanted to see if we could see deformations, local deformations, that would be induced by this polymer. So a little inhomogeneous pressure tool that would be brought to a deformable surface should induce a deformation that we could measure. You can try to see if you can deform substrate just by grafting the polymers to it. And even with DNAs and bilayers, even the smallest tension that you have on the membrane makes the amplitudes of the deformation very small. So looking at this geometry is not very realistic, at least under an optical microscope. So we decided to look rather into this configuration. And this is why I said it was a little bit related to your talk the other day. So what we did compute was the pressure that the polymer that is confined between two surfaces apply now not on this surface, but on that surface, because what we want to do now is to bring a membrane that would encapsulate the polymer like this, and we wanted to understand what these profiles were, if we could, you know, compute them and so on. And the way we compute the pressure in this case is by starting with the polymer in this situation, writing the partition function, and then making an arbitrary deformation of the surface, and the pressure is the thing that is conjugated to that arbitrary deformation. So this can be done, and the results can be written exactly to some
degree. Saying experimentally you want to take a vesicle and plant it on a ground?
On
the
carpet, that's what we want to do. What is the deformation that the polymer induces on the bilayer?
And then in the other case, how big is the deformation?
You mean in the case
where it's grafted?
Where it's grafted? The thing is that if we were able to do it on a membrane that is almost freely on a substrate and look at the RICM, we should be able to see the tens of nanometers that we expect this deformation to be. But of course, when a membrane is on a substrate, the adhesion is quite strong, and so that doesn't allow for those deformations. If you put it on a vesicle, outside the vesicle, as a matter of fact, Rumiana Dimova did this, and she was able to see the average curvature induced by this thing, but she wasn't able actually to spot the deformation on the membrane.
What is the prediction, for example, for a DNA attached to the
membrane? Tens of nanometers. So it's very small.
Single strand.
For double strand.
Much softer, but double strand.
Sorry?
Single strand was pulled much harder than double strand.
But
a single strand, it should be stronger.
Much stronger.
The experiments that were done were with double strand DNA. So we wanted kind of force the deformation by using this geometry. That's what we wanted to do at the beginning. And we looked into the theory of these. I don't think it's so interesting to talk now about this, but we balanced the deformation of the membrane, the pressure of the polymer, and so on, and came up with diagrams that tell you what we expect should happen when the polymer is confined by the membrane, depending on the adhesion of the membrane to the substrate and on its bending stiffness. So we can describe what happens, how much confinement the chain has, and so on. So I'd be glad to discuss the details of these calculations.
Single chain.
This is single chain. Yeah, our idea is to see the effect of one chain, one polymer chain on membranes. That's what we concentrate on. And if you do exclude volume chains, the diagram becomes more complex and so on. But let's keep it and go to the experiments. So we perform the experiments like this. And Arlette, if you want to jump in at some point, you just tell me, okay, or remark. So we take giant vesicles, functionalize them with biotin, and put them on a substrate with streptavidine. And so what they do is that they adhere strongly, like this. Most of the time, the angle here is almost 90 degrees, it's perhaps 60 to 90. We make these hemispheres. And this is a confocal microscope image of what's going on there. And by RICM, you can actually see these things adhering. In the end, this is the adhesion patch, the region that is there. And you can see them adhering. This is more or less real time. So this is a vesicle that is coming close to the substrate. and it it adheres in the end, it has more or less this this shape. Before getting into the actual DNA substrate where I put these vesicles, let me show you two other images that pose what I think is also an interesting problem to think about from the point of view of membrane adhesion to the substrate. So when we work under conditions where, as a matter of fact, due to light and the presence of another molecule in the solution, the vesicles burst. So if I bring them to a situation which is like this, and from there I do something that bursts the vesicle, I end up on the substrate with these patterns that look like that. So to start with, the vesicle was perhaps adhered, say, over here or over there. And then due to some action that I did, the vesicle burst and the full membrane was adhered to the substrate.
So you break it in a particular spot?
So we believe that we break it at a single spot, yes. We don't do it on purpose, but...
How crack grows, you don't know.
How the crack... No, that we don't know. Of course, what we know is that if this thing was completely symmetric, if I'd break it here, this would grow like that, and in the end, I'd have a perfectly symmetric... Of course. So the question we have is, if I take my final pictures, can I reconstitute the adhesion process from the beginning? Can I, for instance, tell where the original point broke? We don't believe there are several initial pores that open due to regularity of these final shapes. If there are several, probably this would be more complex. So I think it's just a single pore. But somehow you have this object like this, which is under tension, you pop it somewhere, then it starts to spread on the surface, makes these shapes. These are quite typical shapes. And I want to know if one can predict these shapes by saying that I pop it at some point and therefore reconstitute back. I think it's an interesting...
There were some experiments in which people did this, I think, at a larger scale. And when you do that, if you see that it slowly deflates and there is an instability, so it will not grow like a circle.
You mean even for this case, it's symmetric? Yes. I'd be very much interested in learning about that, yes.
Some prediction that typically five or six ripples actually
okay.
In that experiment, which is not what you see.
But you can
well, this is very damped in here. Maybe that's the difference. This is all in solution. The vesicle has some internal viscosity, so the process is probably not very, very fast. It was also in solution, okay. Okay.
Why can't you just watch it first?
We can't. For the conditions we have, we cannot.
What was the problem with your optical method? What is it? When you remember you were showing us these nice rings, you should be able to see them. Because you have this
attachment,
so the
energy
should see how close we can make a movie of how it
moves. Yeah, probably if we spend enough time, maybe we should be able to do it. The thing is that you adsorb all of these vesicles, and we have another molecule in solution that undergoes an isomerization when I apply light. And as a matter of fact, this pops more or less randomly. And most of the time, it happens out of the place where we are looking
at. If you look at one of the vesicles, the wrench is going to pop.
Oh, well, we tried. The ones we look at, they didn't pop. So.
It's some kind of law.
No, I don't know. So,
it's a perfect law, yeah. Yeah.
But
do you know how long it takes for the popping process?
No, I don't. If we had, I'll show you other situations where we can actually look into a vesicle, follow it enough time such that you see the phenomena you are looking at. You see, even to see something like this here, in this case, what we do is that we follow a vesicle and wait until it comes close to the substrate, so you start to see the rings, and then hope that at some point it's going to nucleate and to adhere. But again, this is an experiment where you follow the vesicles, and many of the vesicles, because this, you know, it's an activated nucleation. So many times you follow a vesicle for a very long, long time, and nothing happens. So actually, it's much more easy to look at the surface, say, half an hour later, when everything has adhered, and find these spots, then follow each of these individual events.
But can't you also have like a little needle that pops? After it has appeared,
The times we try to do that, the image that either you don't pop it, you just move it. If you come with a micropipette and touch it, as a matter of fact, it's very hard to pop the vesicle. It moves around, it deforms, it resists, and so on. And the few times where you go really, you know, by brute force and try to perturb it, then it doesn't make these nice pictures, as a matter of fact. It bursts in a much more, you know, impetuous way.
Spark.
Yes. So, okay. So let's go to the origin. So I'd be interested in discussing about this. Well, you know, if you have a few LEDs that take us somewhere.
The parameters, like the,
I know the sizes.
The dynamic parameters.
I know the viscosity of the solution, I know the viscosity of the membrane, that's correct. I know the adhesion. Right, yes. Okay, so we put DNAs on substrates like this. We put a little biotin in the end, and then this is the carpets that we get. We are looking at the DNA carpet. The DNA is stained by yo-yo, and it's moving around. If you look at them, they don't quit the place where they are grafted to. So it's just Brownian motion of an ended graft polymer.
Monodisperse is from a...
What?
Monodisperse.
Yeah, it's monodisperse. It's lambda phage.
Are there correlations between the situation with the two?
You mean between one DNA and another one?
Right. This size versus this situation correlation. If one of them.
You mean if the movement of this one is correlated to the movement of that one?
Not the move. Yeah, I mean they're attached to it, the size change. The size change of one. I mean they're attached. So don't
they're attached. Yes.
So the increase of the size of one correlates with. Are there some kind of under? Is this other flows? Correlated flows, or is it? Like your bundle becomes significantly larger,
they
seem to be fluctuating a lot.
You mean it seems that it is fluctuating more than what you'd expect?
I don't
by
I would expect it on the side, but if you can look, analyze this movement of correlation.
So what what we do on these movies, first of all, we do analyze the time correlation. Intensity of the light on one molecule, and that autocorrelation time gives you a time which is what people have in the literature, you know, 0.4 second is a kind of Zim time. Well, it's not the Zim time in solution because this thing is close to a surface, but it's related to that.
In principle, you could do cross-correlations.
You could do cross-correlations.
That's what I was asking, is whether if one of them becomes larger, the sort of probability of naming one, is it becoming larger or smaller, they couple them?
We kind of were worrying about that in another context, but the reason we didn't do it in here is because we believe that this is already too far apart for being correlated.
Well, you'll see from
And when they are too close, there is this problem of the light spots interfering with one each other. So we are not very optimistic about the possibility of looking into that. What we do see, though...
You could do it with two colors.
You mean having... how do you do that?
Just two different colors and then split the...
There is going to mix.
You have a dichroic mirror that's going to...
What do you mean if you don't?
Because you're looking at one, then they have one color, and then they have another color.
No, they are going to mix. The way we do this is that we bring the stainer and you put it in the solution and intercalate spontaneously.
Yeah, okay.
If I bring a second one, I'm going to make a mixed color, but I have no way of putting one fluorophore in one. Even if I prepare them before, they are going to mix.
This fish type is
there. Hmm?
The fish.
Fish. You mean actually... graph. Right. But then you can always argue that you are going to perturb your...
Yeah, but I think they're far enough when you don't have to worry about it.
Mm. But so what we do is that we do average imaging of these configurations to look at the light distribution and so on. And then you can interpret that light distribution from simple polymetry, as a matter of fact, by convoluting with the point spread function of the instrument. I have a whole section on that, but I don't think we should concentrate on that now.
But you only have resolution in the XY plane.
In here, I have not. I mean, when you want to do a Z, you need to go to the confocal. The people that we collaborate with in Constance in the group of Georg Maret, as a matter of fact, they have done that. There is a PRL out there with the Z variation of the concentration studied by confocal microscopy. Right, so this is what we wanted to do. Bring a vesicle to the top of a carpet such that we encapsulated the DNA. And so I've shown this 2 weeks ago. What it does, it does this. So it's very rare to find these confined bubbles that we are looking for. We found a few. So
that depends on the length of the linker.
So what you can do, I mean, for a physicist at least, we just buy the phospholipids, and the phospholipids came with biotin in the end, and there are two sorts. One is a very, very short spacers of a few carbon. And those ones are not very good because on the streptavidinated carpet, as a matter of fact, they don't attach at all or very little. And then you have these ones that have PEG 2000s attached to it. So they have 44 monomers, and those ones attach nicely, and those are the ones we work with. So here the spacers between the lipid and the biotin is a 44 monomer PEG.
Have you tried shortening? Because it looks like your problem is that your membrane, your vesicle is smaller than full stretch size of your DNA. So if it's really planar surface contact as you're claiming, and if this whole area is smaller than the size of your DNA, there would be no chance for it to create this stem or plumular stem possibility. It has to go inside, then it will come out there. It will form the vesicle polymer.
So something we should know is that when this is attached here, then it cannot go back. Because
That's fine. I'm not questioning that issue. I'm questioning the issue that in your case, most of the DNA are actually expelled out, and
that's
the
true.
Significant part is kept outside.
Mm-hmm.
So if instead of dendrophage, you use something shorter, like, I don't know, rather than 20, 14, 15 or 20 microns long, you use something which is only 3 or 5 microns, but it's still see there, but they would be all fully under the, even if fully stretched, they would be under.
But they'd be fully stretched.
They would not be fully stretched anymore.
What do you mean?
Well, because if I'm confining a polymer in a slit.
So let me show this picture. So
I understand. No,
it doesn't relax because of this. Look at this representation here.
Yeah, what's the problem?
It's because the linkers are at such densities
than
the persistence length. So that we have thousands of these things, and they never relax back.
Average spacing between
the streptavidin completely covers the surface. So the pockets for linking the limiting number of bridges that you make is a matter of fact limited by the number of lipids that you put in the vesicle, not by the streptavidin. So we typically use one biotinylated lipid per 25 total lipids, and that gives perhaps something like 2 nanometers on average between the linkers, up to 1 per 5,000, and that gives about 50 nanometers. So the largest distance between the linkers that we have is still comparable to the persistence length of the DNA. But if you go lower, then vesicle doesn't adhere any longer, because in a nicer way, then it makes pockets and so on, because then the amount of linkers becomes too small.
What is the radius of the vesicle?
These vesicles, they have different radius, but the typical sizes are from 10 to 40, say.
Microns,
yes.
So I guess you could use single-stranded DNA
then,
too?
How do I reveal the single-stranded DNA? Are there markers that reveal it? Isaac was saying that yes.
Well, you will not see DNA itself.
I'm not sure. I said so they didn't know. I said they didn't know that this.
If it doesn't stretch out, then you might see the like little blob.
You will see a blob, and you will see probably you may be able to see the in those regions. You will see a larger distance.
You are talking about single stranded.
Because that one will be much more expensive to stretch like this, so it may not stretch.
No, single stranded DNAs are very hard to see.
No, but I'm saying if it doesn't stretch out.
It will not stretch out.
But then you'll see the indentation of the membrane, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
You say it will not stretch out? Why do you say that?
It may not.
Oh, it may not?
No, there is not. The only reason you're stitching out is exactly what you're saying. If you're stitching it on distances smaller than persistent, like there's nothing else for it to do. It's kinetic retraction.
Right, it cannot relax back, yes.
It's kinetic retraction, it's only closing.
That's true, yes.
But if you made your stitches further out, apart than persistence length, allowing it not to be kinetic retraction.
Right, so from the adhesive point of view, you cannot do that, but of course you can imagine using a polymer which is has a smaller persistence length, and you can still see. But can you look at single-stranded? Is there a marker that in here you just add the yo-yo to the solution and you see it, right? Because you have the fluorophores. Are there fluorophores specific for single-stranded? In the double-stranded it works because it intercalates between the two strands of the DNA.
There are ways to attach it, but I don't think you don't even need that. You can look at your vesicle, and you'll see a difference in the surface with and without DNA.
But maybe you could use a single-stranded DNA with a complementarity section, so you'd have a small part that sort of folds into double strand, so you can see that part, but the vast majority would.
But not the rest of it.
If you want, just to know, like a.
Yeah, we tried to play a different game to try to capture them inside, and that was by collapsing the DNA first with some kind of molecule, and then try to unfold it when it's already between the membrane and the substrate. In the end, that didn't work because that's what makes the vesicle burst, as a matter of fact. When you use this molecule and apply the light conditions that needs to be applied for the DNA to unfold, then the DNA also, which interacts a little bit with these molecules, it's perturbed and it bursts.
What happens when you stitch it with a very low fraction of biotin? The thing becomes bumpy.
Instead of having a nice spot that extends, you have blobs of the vesicle doesn't adhere in a nice way. It adheres a little bit here, a little bit there, and a little bit there.
A fraction of time it doesn't adhere because those stitches are permanent because of the bumping part.
Yeah.
But the top part is more permanent.
The top part is mobile, but so it moves a few angstroms, a few nanometers.
Yeah, but it's going to, why wouldn't it relax the rest of the top?
You mean relax to?
I mean, why wouldn't the top suppressing fluctuations and making it eventually more uniform?
So what we see and what people see, other people that do vesicle adhesion see, is that when the adhesion is very small, you don't have a nice adhesive patch like this, but you have regions which, you know, you adhere a little bit there, and then they keep moving like this. So this is noon perhaps already.
Yeah,
12:30 already? Okay, so maybe I should stop it. I don't know if any of you guys want.
I want to do just a short thing, but I don't know if people want to remember your work.
Yeah, okay, let me stop here and we can keep talking about this later if you want.
Maybe we could do it next week or yeah.
Should I redo a new thing like today, or if there is enough?
I have something. You have something.
No, if you have another part, I think it's better.
Yeah, we have another part. Okay, so maybe Monday afternoon. No, Monday afternoon there is already something. Maybe Tuesday afternoon then.
We can have shorter version of it.
Yeah, right.
So I guess we'll stop then.
No. Arlette is going to do something, and then we stop.
The two of us will.
Since Carlos.
Because Arlette is leaving, she will not be here next week.
Yeah. But it's something that some of you have seen already, but perhaps some of
So this is a little background. I mean, it's standard, but I thought before I go into it. So here, when you pull these vesicles out of giant membranes, so that's also a situation, but usually you do that with a laser tweezer, then the standard way to analyze these data, so we have here it's a little hard to see, I got this, but we have here a tube, a tether here, that's pulled out of a giant vesicle. And a tether has a radius R, and then a length L, and then there is, now this should have gone to here, but the length of the vesicle is L, and then the radius of the length of the tether is L, and the radius of the vesicle is capital R. And so you can write down a free energy that has a bending part, and the bending part is here, the bending part of the vesicle is 12 plus, you know, some on here, this edge over here they put in. And then there is the bending of the tube here. So kappa is the bending modulus. And then there is a stretching part. And the stretching part is due to the area difference. The area when it's not stretched, the unstretched area and the actual area. And so the stretching part is, you could also describe by surface tension, because the K here is the stretch modulus, and that's related to the surface tension that way. And then there is a part, because there could be osmotic pressure difference, and so this is the osmotic pressure times the total volume in the vesicle and the tether. And then there is because you pull with some force F, there is a term that is just the pulling force times L. And so when you then say, okay, this system minimizes its free energy, then you set these terms to zero. And I mean, this is all standard. It's in the book of Phillips and so on. And you get the result is that the pressure difference goes as 1 over the radius of the vesicle. And usually, these are giant vesicles. So the pressure difference, you say, you neglect here. It's approximately zero. And then you can get a relation between the radius of your tube and it's just related to the bending modulus and then to the surface area, which depends on the amount of stretching. And so that's been verified in the experiments von Schwabus and others did that. And also you have a force here, and the force is also related to these two parameters. And so what you have is you pull off this tether at a constant force. So you basically get coexistence of these two, you know, the vesicle and the tether over there. So that's just some background so on how people deal with this tether pulling. And so,
can I just ask a question?
Of course.
Of course, this doesn't include the extraction of the area from fluctuations, right? Is it already in the regime where you are actually stretching the membrane?
Right. I mean, So you kind of stretching the membrane over there. The surface tension, actually, part of what you do is just, you know, kind of, you know, getting rid of fluctuations when you extract
the
tube. That is what the surface tension is related.
Put the equation there.
Yeah.
It's in that term.
It's in that.
If you look at the definition of sigma, it's exactly the fluctuation.
Yeah. So it's exactly the fluctuation term. So it is the change in the. So you change. So this is.
And what's K?
Yeah.
K is
that
the equation?
No,
K is the stretch modulus. It's related to the bending. I mean, there's some relation between the stretch
no,
and bend modulus.
No, stretching is not.
Yeah,
you are not
stretching.
Extracting area from the fluctuations. In this picture, you are extracting areas from the actual stretching of the membrane, which is in here, right?
Well, it's.
And this,
but.
This is usually pretty stiff, right? If you look at the relation between. Tension under the relative area that you extract. If you are going to work with a normal spring, of course, it's just a straight line. But for membranes, what happens is that in here, you almost have nothing. You are extracting fluctuations, and you have something that is pretty stiff.
But you're assuming that there's no fluctuations in the tube.
There's no fluctuation in the tube, for sure. The issue is that how the surface area here, the surface tension, so there's no fluctuations in the tube. So you just pull out.
If I try to pull fluctuations out of a membrane, the first 2% are from fluctuations, and then maybe the next few percent will come from the actual stretch.
Marcus, but that happens only at near zero membrane tension, right? That if.
Yeah.
If initially in your vesicle the internal pressure is much higher than external, then in a sense these fluctuations already
if
are small.
If it stands already, then they have been already.
Typically,
as shown in your graph, is that if as your sigma is just a little bit below zero, then you're already in the regime where you don't.
Typically, you do this in a regime where sigma is constant. So typically, you see that initially when you pull this, and this is the regime where I talk about, the radius here is constant. So you pull something out at a constant radius. So you have a constant sigma, so you kind of flatten out
but
the situation.
But your initial sigma before pulling, is it near zero or is it way above zero? Because that's a crucial point for that graph.
It is above zero, but it's also this is Thierry's experiment from François Bouchard 20 years ago or so.
Yeah.
And so
is there strong osmotic pressure inside?
No.
This is the osmotic pressure term.
Oh, it's zero.
This is the osmotic pressure. So assume that it is zero. Sigma is so there
but
is
in
a
Laplace
difference.
Equation, your sigma is zero too. Like before pulling, if your osmotic pressure difference is zero, then your sigma is also zero.
Well, sigma of r is zero. R is large.
No, sigma is zero. But yeah, sigma of r is zero. That's
correct. Yeah, r is large. So yeah. Sigma
is sigma the same for the vesicle and for the tube?
Yeah, yeah.
So you're assuming the fluctuations or stored lengths are similar in what places?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just surprised because I know that you cannot stretch these bilayers by a lot. I mean. This regime here is usually very small. You start to
but this area of the tube, so R.
This thing is almost incompressible.
But in this theory, small r, the radius, as well as the length of the tube, is way, way smaller as capital R. So the area here is maybe of the whole membrane compared to the giant vesicle is maybe you know, 1/100, 1/1000. I mean, it's really, you know, kind of, it's very small. It's almost, so that's the background. So we applied some of that to the mitochondria. So here you see a membrane of a healthy mitochondria. So there is this, it's the inner mitochondrial membrane that's only shown here. And the inner mitochondrial membrane is much larger than the inner boundary membranes. And it's much larger as the size of the mitochondria. So you get all these cristae going here inside. And the group where I work in biology in San Diego, Fry and Sun and also Perkins at UCSD and others, have been looking at the structure with tomography, with cryotomography and with tomography. And they found that this is the structure of the healthy mitochondria. And when you...
This is all continuous,
I'm standing. This is all continuous, so these are different colors, but it's all the same in our mitochondrial membrane. It's all continuous. And so you have here, I have a better picture on the next slide, so then. And when you when there's apoptosis, broken cell death, the structure is lost. And you get all these different vesicles over there. So here, this is a better slide of the structure. So all continuous here, all one color. And so here you have these slices. And here there's just one of these slices. And so you have a circular part here, and you have tubules going to the ends. And so here, they just made these sizes of the tubules red over here. So to show you that you have a tube that really has some kind of little radius over here. So what the radius? About 10 nanometers. So you have flat regions and tubular regions over there that coexist. And so we tried, what we did is we wanted to see if we could explain this with a free energy model as a, you know, thermodynamic state, of an equilibrium thermodynamic state. Now, the only way that we could come up with a model was to put in a force, to say, okay, there could be a force, because the only way that you can have a force, so we have these two regions here. We have these lamellar regions and the tubular regions, and the only way that they could be both a minimum of the free energy is when you have a force. So the way that we are postulating where the force comes from is from motivated by this work by Roux that was in PNES, where they used that, they do the same thing. They did a giant vesicle, they pull on it, they have an optical trap, and then they add dynamine.
So what was your argument why you need force?
Because it's when you have, okay, that is, it came from some experiments, like when you have a polymer and you start pulling on it, you get the stem and flower idea. So you have the stem and the flower, and you apply a force, you have a stem and a flower in coexistence. And so we first did it without a force, but you could get a tube as a minimum, but there's no way to get the same, the tube as well as the flat.
I mean, that's definitely one way to get a stem and a flower, but in polymers, if you have, I guess, full electrolytes and so on, you could come up with situations where you could probably have things like that even without force, right?
Well,
you just need special things going on. I mean,
okay, so you need special things going on. So there are alternatives. So we said, let's see if we can explain it with the force and not say that there are special things. You could, of course, have electrostatic differences. You could have, you know, a polymers sitting over here in these areas over here. You could have a polymer that forms a ring that wants to make that structure. You could have, you know, inclusions in one leaflet of the membrane, but there are many theories, but this was the way that
negative
we approached this. Yeah, different surface tensions in different areas. Yeah.
Right.
So you would have differences. I mean, you cannot have one, I think. So anyhow, so we assume now that the way that this force is generated is similar to what Roux et al. Has seen, is that they added dynamine. And when they add dynamine, they see that the force they need to keep this tube here is dropping. So the dynamine exerts a polymerization force because there's a low energy when it's attached to the tube. And so you get this spiral over there. So there is a dynamin-like protein, OPA1. And remember that I showed you that here, this the apoptosis, the structure is lost. Now here, OPA1 is released. Yeah, so there is a protein, at least dynamin-like, at least think, could be responsible for that polymerization force. And so...
So it polymerizes on the outside of the membrane?
Yeah, outside of the tube. Outside of the tube there. So it's not... So when you have the tube over here, it would polymerize here around the outside of these tubes.
But if you don't pull the tube, can it induce the tube formation spontaneously? Like if you don't apply external force, can dynamin polymerization itself somehow induce formation of this
membrane? You need to have a tube initially, but it could change the radius of the tube. So when you make a tube, so dynamin likes this, you know, kind of the 10 nanometer radius, but I believe that when you make a tube a little bigger, 16, 17, then dynamin can make them to 10, so it can do some more.
But that means that in mitochondria, there is something else that's pulling that dynamin polymerizes. Is that the model then?
No, we think that the dynamin is pulling it.
But who was initially making it?
That's, you know, that are some of the questions that we don't, you know, what's initially making it. So you know, how would you get this from just a bunch of lipids? So we just say when it's there, then we can come up. So we have then this model over here that we say, okay, one of these crystals you can describe as a flat part and tubes. And now we can write down a free energy similar to what was done. Now, one of the things is we cannot neglect the pressure difference over here, because the pressure difference was neglected because he had a giant vesicle, and he said it was of the order of 1 over the capital R of the giant vesicle. But here we have only these flat spots over here, and this is about 20 nanometers, and so we don't have these large sizes, so we cannot just throw that term away. So we cannot just do it simply analytically, we have to do it numerically on the computer. But we can come up with a similar term over here, and we can minimize it and calculate it. And so we predict a tensile force that's about 20 piconewtons. That's close to what this polymerization force is. And the other terms, this should have been a sigma and a delta P. I don't know why it's. So the surface tension is about 0.09 piconewton per nanometer. So that's reasonable. It's not.
You decide yourself how much N is, right? N is not the variable that you minimize.
Okay, so yeah, so I should say, so we measure, and so there was one of, you know, the grad students looked at lots of these pictures and did very careful measurements, and she got the values for N and for the length of the tubes, and for the little r was about 10, and, you know, capital R, and, you know, I have somewhere a table with all these measurements. So we measure that from the data, and then we calculate the tensile force, surface tension, and pressure difference. And they come out to be, you know, reasonable values. This surface tension, it's lower than like the 0.2 or so at which your membrane would break. But it's still, you know, it's not like close to zero here. Well, that was for the giant vesicles. And so something else that's been seen, which I think is interesting in this context, is that the ATP synthesis turns out to be a dimer. So this is the ATP synthesis. ATP synthesis, of course, making ATP is what the mitochondrial membrane does. And it is a dimer, and it lives in these curved areas. So this would be a tube that lives in, and this would be the flat portions of the membrane, which are curved on the sides. And so the people that did this, Strauss et al., they argue that, you know, kind of when you have the ATP synthesis in the curved areas, then there's a bigger pH difference, and that would make the synthesis work better and so on. So that they're having these curved areas in the mitochondria are important for what the mitochondria is supposed to do. So that's what I did in membranes, a little bit less open questions or so, but since Carlos asked me, but tell us something about your membranes. So that's what we were doing.
But also this ATP synthesis would probably change the energy, right? Like the energetics of the curving.
Well, there is some issue is the ATP synthesis going here because it's curved, or is the ATP synthesis causing the curvature? I mean, it's the chicken and the egg problem, and I don't know which one.
Is, yeah.
Like
if you have a That's something we, I think, going to discuss, is that if you have a stress-sensitive protein that it prefers to go to curved areas.
Yeah.
Another way to think about that is that it sort of induces spontaneous curvature.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So that's the other way around. And actually, people in this paper say that this, you know, the curvature is caused by the ATP synthesis, and I don't know what's wisdom there, but definitely when you
are there any experiments on blowing the mitochondria, you know, putting them in smaller osmotic pressure outside and just to see how this is would inflate, because that might reveal some of its internal structure, you know.
It is multiple.
Yes, it's multiple.
So it will not blow up very nice, it will break.
It has lots of handles.
And also, it's a question. Is the inside actually?
Maybe they could be consumed by the.
No, it breaks. I mean, there's an inner membrane which I showed you, and then there is an outer membrane, and you can break the outer membrane, and then the inner membrane comes out. But at some point, the membranes break before they kind of really lose their structure. But yeah, you can just.
I guess another question is that if you do a mutation to FTP synthase so it does not go into mitochondria, will you still get mitochondria without FTP synthase? Or is it
you get onion rings.
So then you get
these onion rings that.
Which basically tells you that ATP synthase is the necessary energetic part of
mitochondria. Yeah, it is.
So I think for the question of its structural energetics, probably it's an essential part.
But you also this way.
Yeah, but when you have ATP. But when you have ATP synthesis there, but no OPA1, you also lose the structure. So both have to.
Another component that is important.
The crystal membrane are those essentially separate vesicles that are just in strange shapes? Is that?
So this is, we colored it so that it's got, so but what you have to think of is that there is a space here in between the gray and the blue that goes all the way in all these crystals. That's the inner membrane space. And then there's another space that's the matrix space. So there's only two different spaces. So this membrane divides the intermembrane and the matrix space, but it's all one connected area.
So the whole mitochondria is, There's only two spaces,
and everything
else is in, and they're all interconnected.
Okay. And it's believed that that's also important for the functioning.
The cell is not that much different, by the way. I mean, the cell itself is not much different.
That's right.
Depending on the artists.
But the larger scale tells you that local curvatures and so on are much more flatter, right?
Okay.